Good morning. On today's programme, is there potential for the reunification of the island of Cyprus and the role of cricket in diplomatic relations between India and Pakistan? But we begin today with Japan, where the country's first ever female prime minister has just been appointed. Sanae Takaichi's historic election marks a major step forward for gender equality in a country dominated by a male patriarchy. She faces many economic problems in a country struggling with high inflation and rising costs. Brian Gaynor has this report.
Last Tuesday, Sanae Takaichi became Japan's 104th prime minister and the first woman to hold the job. Her election marks a big step forward for gender equality in one of the world's most patriarchal democracies. To put her achievement in perspective, Japan ranks 118th in the Global Gender Index. Ireland, by comparison, is ranked 10th. Only 16% of Japan's lower house of parliament are female. Of the approximately 1,600 companies listed on the Japanese stock exchange, less than 1% have female CEOs. And females are legally forbidden from becoming Empress of Japan. That she has succeeded against such deeply ingrained male chauvinism is to be respected. Yet she is no firebrand feminist. She regards the concept of work-life balance as an unwelcome import of Western wokeness. She agrees that imperial succession should remain male-only, and she is ardently opposed to permitting married couples have separate surnames. This is her socially conservative side to the fore. Conversely, there is also a more progressive side to Sanae Takaichi too, albeit less prominent. She has just appointed the first ever female Minister of Finance. She has also spoken publicly about her own health struggles with menopause and has pledged to expand access to women's health services. Such nuances of character are perhaps indicative of her humble background. Unlike other former prime ministers, she is not the scion of an established political dynasty. Her career in many respects mirrors that of her political hero, Margaret Thatcher. She grew up in a sleepy suburb of Nara, the ancient capital of Japan. Her mother worked for the city's police force. Her father was an employee of a car parts manufacturer. As a university student, she played drums in a heavy metal band and cites Deep Purple and Iron Maiden as two of her favourite bands. She was first elected to Parliament in 1993 as a member of the Liberal Democratic Party, and over the years has served several stints as a government minister, overseeing economic security, internal affairs and communications. Politically, she is most closely linked with Shinzo Abe, a former prime minister who was assassinated in 2022. She favours a more assertive role for Japan's armed forces and wants to complete Abe's aim of revising the post-war constitution in order to do this. She also shares his revisionist approach to Japan's wartime history. Like him, she has consistently argued that Japan's atrocities committed during World War II have been overstated. She is a regular visitor to the Yasukuni Shrine, a memorial in Tokyo honouring Japan's war dead, including convicted war criminals. This has brought criticism from both South Korea and China, who see such visits as deliberate provocations to their respective countries. Domestically, political challenges also await. First and foremost is how to revitalize the fortunes of the Liberal Democratic Party. The past year has seen the party suffer a series of electoral losses as populist hard-right parties make inroads into their conservative base. Unlike Abe, Takaichi does not have a parliamentary majority and needs to rely on a newly established coalition with the fractious Japan Innovation Party to pass legislation. Some deft political skills are also required with Japan's closest ally, the United States. Japan's previous Prime Minister, Shigeru Ichiba, agreed to a massive $500 billion investment with President Trump in order to avoid the imposition of crippling tariffs. Trump is due to arrive in Japan next week, and Takaichi can only hope that he doesn't demand that Japan show him the money. Yet, it is her plans for Japan's sluggish economy that will concern voters the most. Persistent inflation, particularly rising food prices and fuel costs, stagnant wages, labour supply shortages, a weak yen, and rising interest rates have all combined to erode people's standard of living. Looming behind it all is the unceasing demographic pressure being exerted by Japan's rapidly aging population and its plummeting birth rate. Solutions to these problems are necessary, but not easy. Takeuchi has already made pledges to expand government spending, cut taxes, and provide subsidies to the less well-off, but details are vague. Many of these proposals have been tried before, but to little notable effect. If she does succeed in changing Japan's fortunes for the better, then Sanae Takeuchi may well emulate her mentor, Shinzo Abe, in being one of the country's most effective and consequential prime ministers. If, like so many of her predecessors, she disappoints, then she will probably only be remembered as Japan's first female prime minister. And that would disappoint her. For World Report, this is Brian Gaynor in Japan.
In Cyprus, the potential for reunification of the island is back on the cards following the election of a new president last week. Tufan Ehirman won in Turkish-occupied northern Cyprus and has said he will resume negotiations with Greek Cypriots with the aim of reunifying the island. The Turkish population in northern Cyprus have elected a leader that Ankara did not want to win, as Jasper Mortimer reports.
Cyprus is one of the world's intractable problems. Its two peoples, Greek speakers and Turkish speakers, have lived under separate administrations since 1974, when Turkey invaded the island after Greek Cypriot fanatics seized power, hoping to unite Cyprus with Greece. Today, UN peacekeepers patrol the Green Line between the northern third of Cyprus, where the Turks live, and the south, where the Greek majority lives. Umpteen attempts have been made to reunite the two communities. UN Secretary Generals have hosted many meetings between the leaders. The closest they came to reconciliation was in 2004, when a plan negotiated under Secretary General Kofi Annan was put to a referendum. Turkish Cypriots voted yes, Greek Cypriots voted no. The Cyprus problem is encapsulated by the French phrase, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it is the same. But every now and then a breakout occurs. Turkish or Greek Cypriots elect a leader with new ideas on how to reconcile, and optimists hope that the page can be turned permanently. A breakout occurred last Sunday when Turkish Cypriots ousted their president and elected Tufan Erhoman, a 55-year-old professor of law turned politician. Erhoman beat the incumbent, Ersin Tatar, by 63% of the vote to 36%. No candidate had won by that much for more than 20 years. Erhoman's win was significant for three reasons. Firstly, Turkish Cypriots had defied Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, who had backed Tatar. The motherlands have influence in Cyprus, Turkey more so than Greece, as Ankara bankrolls the Turkish Cypriot government. Erdogan had sent his vice president, two former cabinet ministers, and a well-known Islamic cleric to campaign for Tatar. Secondly, the results showed that Turkish Cypriots do want to resume negotiations with their Greek counterparts. Under Ankara's guidance, Tatar had pushed for Cyprus to be partitioned into a Turkish state and a Greek one. Greek Cypriots rejected this outright, and consequently, there were no negotiations during Tatar's 5 years in office. Erhoman seeks a loose federation of the two communities. At the moment, Turkish Cyprus is isolated. To travel in Europe, Turkish Cypriots need a passport issued by the Republic of Cyprus, as the Greek Cypriot government is known. To fly to London or to Dublin, Turkish Cypriots have to cross the Green Line and fly from Larnaca Airport, or they fly to Istanbul and change planes there. The Turkish Cypriot airport, Ercan, is not on the international flight map. As Erhoman has said, Turkish Cypriot people cannot live in diplomatic limbo forever. Thirdly, Erhoman's victory was a vote for secularism, a rejection of the Islamic culture that Erdogan has promoted. Tata went so far as to authorize schoolgirls to wear the headscarf. This provoked a storm of protests, in which Erdogan took part. When the results came through, Erdogan gracefully congratulated Erdogan. But Erdogan's political ally, the ultranationalist Devlet Bahçeli, rubbished the election, saying the turnout of 65% was too low. He called on the Turkish Cypriot parliament to annul the election and to ask Turkey to annex Turkish Cyprus. His remarks show that a segment of Turkey believes it is the lord and master of North Cyprus. Turkish liberals, on the other hand, were delighted by Erdogan's victory. If Turkish Cypriots can stand up to Erdogan, so can we, was their thinking. South of the Green Line, the Greek Cypriot president, Nikos Christodoulidis, congratulated Erdogan. He said they should resume negotiations from where they broke off in 2017. All of this is good news, but Cypriots have been here before. Leaders who championed reunification have been elected before. One thinks of Mustafa Akinci on the Turkish side and George Vassiliou on the Greek side. Perhaps the biggest problem in the Cyprus problem is that it has endured so long that people are comfortable with the status quo. They know that to reunite, concessions will have to be made, and the status quo is not so painful that they are prepared to concede. This is the nut that Erdogan and Christodoulidis will have to crack. For World Report, this is Jasper Mortimer in Ankara.
Historically, cricket has served as a fragile bridge in relations between India and Pakistan. But following the recent armed conflict between India and Pakistan, the cricket field has suddenly turned into a battlefield. During the recent Asia Cup in Dubai, Indian and Pakistani cricketers refused to shake hands at the behest of their respective governments, plunging the gentleman's game into disrepute. Sajida Momin has this report.
After the four-day India-Pakistan war in May, which New Delhi called Operation Sindoor, the two South Asian nuclear-armed nations are now treating the game of cricket as war. In the just-concluded Asia Cup tournament in Dubai, there were three India-Pakistan matches, but the captains and players of the two teams did not shake hands, as is customary, before or after the games. There were no group photos either. On the playing field itself, rival players mimicked and recreated scenes from the largely aerial armed conflict in May in a naked display of jingoistic fervour, although cricket is called the gentleman's game. So much so, the victorious Indian team refused to accept the trophy from the Asian Cricket Council chairman, Mohsin Naqvi, who also happens to be the Interior Minister of Pakistan. The Indians insisted that a non-Pakistani official does the honours, but Naqvi refused to budge and ultimately left the stadium with the glittering cup rather than be upstaged. What follows were bizarre scenes of the Indian team celebrating their victory, holding aloft an imaginary trophy instead of the real thing. Heartbroken cricket buffs are naturally lamenting the loss of bonhomie and camaraderie among Pakistani and Indian players, who have evidently become pawns in the hands of manipulative politicians who don't care about cricketing spirit or sportsmanship. Journalists covering the controversy-marred Asia Cup tournament in UAE reported that the captains and managers of the Indian and Pakistani teams were taking orders from their respective governments in New Delhi and Islamabad, reducing them to the proverbial puppets on a string. Both captains held political and provocative pre- and post-match press conferences, which had nothing to do with cricket and fanned enmity between the two countries. Dubai police had a tough time maintaining peace in the galleries, preempting with great difficulty physical clashes between fired-up fans in the stands. Notably, both teams publicly announced with great pride that they were donating their prize money to their country's armed forces for their valour and bravery during the brief war. If any proof of governmental role in militarising India-Pakistan cricket was needed, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who heads India's right-wing nationalist dispensation, readily provided it. No sooner India scored the winning run against Pakistan, lifting the Asia Cup, Modi tweeted, "Operation Sindoor on the games field, outcome is the same. India wins. Congrats to our cricketers." Modi's astonishing remarks hailing cricket as war left millions of peace-loving people and cricket lovers speechless. But Ram Guha, eminent historian and one of India's foremost public intellectuals, articulated their despair. He called Modi's post hasty, ill-conceived, politically imprudent, and absolutely unbefitting of his office. Another commentator, Sushant Singh, who served in the Indian Army for 20 years before branching off into journalism, wrote that Modi's message isn't merely tone-deaf celebration. In Singh's words, it represented something far more sinister, the deliberate equation of sporting triumph with military conflict, treating cricket victory as an extension of actual warfare where people die. According to the soldier-turned-analyst, equating cricket with military operations doesn't elevate sports. It reduces war to entertainment in public consciousness. When the Prime Minister of a nuclear-armed nation treats warfare like a cricket match, he makes future conflict more likely by stripping them of moral weight. Besides Ram Guha and Sushant Singh, there are many others who are convinced that the Modi government is turning the Indian cricket team into the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's sporting arm for political consolidation and electoral benefit. Even Mike Atherton, former captain of the English cricket team, has angrily observed that cricket between India and Pakistan should be immediately halted because cricket, which was once the vehicle for diplomacy, is now clearly a proxy for fanning tensions and propaganda. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curdy. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.